Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Series 8, Episode 1 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Hello. I can't believe I've got to 8 series. This was definitely a podcast that was meant to be something for me to do during lockdown, maybe for a couple of series. And now here we are, 8 series later. I believe, I might be wrong, you know I get things wrong, but I believe this is the 102nd episode. It is incredible that 102 people have shared their story with me. And a few more, actually, because I've got some in the bank to release in the coming weeks. So if you're a new listener, hello, welcome. There's loads in the back catalogue. Go and have a look through. And if you've been here since the beginning, I really appreciate it. If you're someone that likes the podcast, please do share it with your friends. The more listeners we get, the more I can make. I love making this podcast. It is a real passion project for me, and I appreciate every single person that listens to it. I have got a great episode for you today. Liv Hewson, a brilliant actor who, well, there's lots of things that they've been in, but something that I have loved recently is Yellow Jackets. I absolutely loved it, and I was delighted that Liv took the time to come and chat to me. So that'll be coming up shortly. But as ever, I will share a couple of emails from the listeners. If you want to get in touch, you always can. If you want to share your story with me, please do. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. Okay, let's start here. Hi, Susie. I've been listening since the beginning, but I finally decided I wanted to write in to say thank you. Your podcast couldn't have started at a better time. When lockdown began, I went from being at university, where I was able to be my openly queer, authentic self, to having to move back home, where I'm a shell of myself, being forced back into the closet due to not being out to my parents and having to censor my opinions and thoughts to avoid conflict in the home that I was stuck in. Living in a homophobic household as a queer person began taking its toll on my mental health, and as lockdown progressed, I felt that all the hard work I had done untangling my internalized homophobia and finding out who I really was being undone. But all was not lost. I discovered your podcast, and quickly other podcasts with queer representation, including like-minded friends, began appearing on Spotify. Each day I went for a walk, I could put on my headphones and listen to you talk to people who were part of the LGBTQIA+ community. It was an hour a day where I felt seen, connected, and part of the community, which I had lost all contact with. As we all know, a lockdown eventually ended, and I managed to move away from my family and begin to rebuild my life again. I'm now a teacher. And unlike many teachers in the past, especially during Section 28, I am so fortunate to be able to be my authentic queer self at school. I created the first LGBTQIA+ space for students, which formed a safe space for students to ask questions, share worries, and meet like-minded friends. Sorry that this is long-winded. It's not at all. It's been a beautiful email. But the reason that I wanted to get in touch is to say thank you for the podcast and the incredible guests who speak so openly about their experiences. Each listener to this podcast will have their own unique story, and now all have a shared sense of belonging through listening. So if anyone feels alone, just know you are part of this community who are all listening to this great podcast. And this person has been asked to stay anonymous, so I will, of course, respect that wish. But thank you so much for getting in touch. And I thought it's the beginning of the year, so I thought sharing one from a teacher, beginning of the school year, I should say, sharing one from a teacher felt like a nice thing to do. So what lucky kids at that school. What lucky young people to have a teacher like you. I wish I'd had a teacher like you. But thank you for listening. And I'm so pleased that during lockdown, this podcast provided the community that you needed. That's exactly why I did it. So thank you. Right, let's have another one. Dearest Susie, you will never know the invaluable comfort you and Tom Allen have brought me over the last couple of years. That's a very nice thing to say. I'm sitting here rather late at night when I should be in bed, thinking, you're never going to write that email to Susie Ruffle unless you do it right now. I was wondering what your thoughts are on someone deciding they were better off not being in a relationship, possibly ever. I'm a gay American man. Trust me, I know. What the fuck are they even doing in this country? I've had 3 long-term relationships in my life, and each was tumultuous and tragic in its own way. With each, there was a bridge I simply couldn't cross with them, and I ended the relationships to find myself feeling so incredibly free and relieved. I certainly brought my own issues to each. I've been diagnosed with anxiety disorders and something called avoidant personality disorder. Most of us have experienced and even exhibited avoidant behaviour to some degree in our lives, because it's a very common thing. We all have things that we want to avoid in life. AVPD takes that to the extreme. I avoid so many things to a detrimental degree. The nature of a personality disorder, however, is that my entire personality has malformed around a set of behaviours and codes. It's so ingrained in everything that I do, which means I'm constantly finding new ways that my brain has gone to absurd lengths to try and avoid any uncomfortable feeling. I know, it's a lot, but they don't call them personality disorders because they're a good time. Unfortunately, this means there's no truly getting rid of it, only learning and adjusting and doing my best every day. The point of this is, I have a very exhausting time living with myself many days. The mental load is immense, and the more aware you are of it, not to mention my physical medical conditions, but yeesh, who has the time? Add on to that anxiety and an entire other human being, the thought just stresses me out. Being in the situation stresses me out. I start to feel trapped and misunderstood. I struggle to open up about things, and no matter how much I try and explain or talk about it, people don't seem to really understand how complicated it is. Makes figuring out myself and a relationship. Before the last one ended, I said if this one doesn't work, I was done. I didn't have it in me to do a relationship again. I didn't know if that would be permanent or not, but it's certainly what I felt like then and feel more and more every day now. Maybe I'll change my mind someday, but maybe not. I've been asked if I'm aromantic or asexual, and I've given it a lot of thought, but I'm really not. I experience both attractions. While I definitely think there's good and nice parts to having a boyfriend, I just think that a relationship is too much of a mental drain on my already maxed out brain and body. I guess I ask because I don't feel that one often sees people talking about choosing to be alone indefinitely. At least I don't. So what do you think, Susie? Is it acceptable or normal to say, I'm good to the whole relationship thing? Or should I consider giving it another shot? Your perspective would mean the world. The work you've done with this podcast has provided a measurable value to the world, and I truly believe it's made it a bit of a better place. That is a very kind thing to say. Please give my love to Tom and keep up the amazing work. All my love, Justin. And Justin said, feel free to name me. Well, first of all, Justin, I mean, I'm only a comedian, and I don't have the answers. And, you know, I would be the last person to sort of try and sound like I'm a therapist or I understand sort of psychology or behaviour disorders or anything like that. But if you want my opinion as your sort of podcast friend that you've not met yet, I would say if it feels right to you, then it's probably right. If it feels better for you every day more and more that you prefer not being in a relationship, then you're probably right. You know? And sometimes things change. And sometimes feelings change, and sometimes you meet people that change those feelings. But I think it is acceptable and normal to say that you don't want a relationship. I think whatever feels right for you is acceptable and normal. You know, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, why shouldn't it be? I don't know if that's useful. I don't know that I give the best advice, but I wanted to share this email because I thought it was really honest and very brave to share your feelings with me and the listeners. And maybe someone's listening who feels very similar, and that might have been helpful to them. With regards to what I think, I don't know how great my advice is, but I think trust your gut. If it's feeling better and better for you every day, then do that. And like, love comes in all shapes and ways into your life, doesn't it? Like you mentioned Tom Allen, who I do my other podcast, Like Minded Friends, with. You know, he brings a different kind of love into my life that's not, you know, it's not a relationship like the relationship I have with my wife, of course, but, you know, someone understanding you. It doesn't need to be someone that you're in a relationship with. It can be a dear friend that just gets you. I don't know. Maybe that's helpful. Maybe it's not. But I appreciate, Justin, you getting in touch and being so honest. Okay. Should we get on with today's conversation? I think we should. I don't know if any of what I just said made sense, but hopefully it did to Justin. Okay, as I mentioned, I've got a brilliant episode with Liv Houston. I loved this. I think you can tell all the way through how excited I am. I hope that it comes across as sort of just loving it rather than cringe, but if it's cringe, don't tell me. Okay, here's that conversation. Oh, listener, I am so excited for today's guest. Honestly, maybe the most excited I've been all year. Liv Houston is who I'm speaking to you today. And Liv is in my favourite TV show of the last couple of years, the compulsively watchable Yellow Jackets, which has just been nominated for Outstanding Drama Series at the Emmys. And Liv is outstanding as Van, a young footballer who gets stranded in the wilderness after a plane crash. A beautiful, empathetic and tender performance. You might have also seen them in Netflix Santa Clarita Diet or in the series Top of the Lake, a force of nature on screen, and I am delighted they've taken the time to chat to me today. Hello, Liv.
Hi, oh my god, that's so nice. Thank you.
Well, I'm thrilled. When I saw that you'd watched one of my videos on Instagram, I was like, oh my god, I need to, oh, hello. It was very, very keen of me because my wife and I absolutely devoured Yellow Jacket. So you must be having quite a moment at the moment.
Oh man. I mean, it's so funny to think about it because it's like, I mean, like, yeah, like the show's doing really well. It's awesome. But then I drive myself a little nuts thinking about it because I'm like, well, what does that mean exactly? Like, I don't know that my day to day is that different, but it's really exciting. And like, I love the show. I'm very proud of it. So it's always a thrill to see people respond to it in ways that are similar to how I get excited about it. And, you know, it's just like, it's what you want when you make stuff. Like, you want it to reach people and you want people to see what has got you so excited about making it. So it's like a positive feedback loop. It's really lovely.
How was it when you first got the script?
Okay, so the script was the first thing that excited me about it. When I auditioned for the pilot, my primary reaction was like, oh, I just hope this pilot gets picked up. Like, I hope this show gets made. I remember walking into audition for it thinking like, oh, listen, if I don't get this, like, I'm excited to watch it. Like, Yellow Jackets is exactly the kind of show that I would just be watching as an audience member anyway. So as an actor, like, that's the most exciting stuff to then get to be a part of as well.
Now, you live in LA now, is that right?
I do.
But you're an Aussie.
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Canberra, which is the capital of Australia. It's like a little politics town. It's like in between Sydney and Melbourne on the southeast. That's where I'm from.
Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah, of course. Right. You would have performed there.
Yeah. I think I did a show there at one point. So tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Canberra.
Yeah.
Were you sort of a theatre kid?
I was.
Don't worry, me too. Yeah. You said that like apologetically. That is exactly what I want to hear. I'm like, me too.
It's funny because it's not apology exactly, but it is a sort of like, there's a settling in to it. It's not resignation. It's like, but it's a sort of settling. Or it's like, yeah, I really fucking was, dude. Like, I should, like, absolutely. I started training with like a theater company in my hometown as a teenager. That's like how I learned how to do this on a technical level. But I was also like, I did drama in high school to like the most intense extent possible, you know, like that was always a primary focus for me. Canberra is like a little on the smaller side. It's like a population of about 400,000, I think. And it's very green and sort of like spread out and quiet. It was like designed in one go on purpose. So like, it's quite structured, like it's a lot of concentric circles, there's a lot of roundabouts. and there's a lot of like very beautiful land like nearby, a lot of like strange, interesting public sculpture. Like it's quite beautiful and it's quiet. And I always used to say about Canberra that like it's a lovely place to be a child and it's like a calm, lovely place to be an adult, but it's a terrible place to be a teenager. Which is maybe more about just what my experience was like than what the city is like.
Because there's nothing to do.
Yeah, it's a lot of like being bored and getting drunk in parks, you know, and like, it's sure. Like, okay, I guess we'll either make some art or some trouble and maybe both, maybe we'll end up doing both of those things.
Sometimes that's where the best art comes from.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so there was a lot of like learning how to entertain yourself in good and bad ways, you know.
And do you think that's where the joy of the theatre, like make-believe?
I think so. I mean, storytelling was always very important to me and it was always very important in the house I grew up in. And I was a really big reader as a kid. Like there was always music around and it was just kind of like woven into our lives as a matter of course, where it's like, well, yeah, like for pleasure, you would learn to play an instrument, or like for pleasure, you would watch a movie and then dissect what was interesting about the movie, or like for pleasure we'll go and like listen to this band that's playing in a park or whatever. Like this is like an active ongoing thing that is like woven into what it's like to be a person. It's like it's important, but it's also every day. So it always mattered to me and I always loved it. But like performing, I realized that I liked in a specific way when I was a kid, like just as opportunities came up to do it, I very quickly was like, oh yeah, I think it's gonna be this forever for me. Yeah. I think that's it.
What was it like growing up there? Because I've travelled a bit around Australia and I've interviewed lots of Australians on this show. What was it like for you in Canberra as a young queer person?
Yeah, what was it like?
Were you aware of any queer people around? Did you see anyone and go, like I remember seeing some lesbians and it was thrilling that they existed.
Oh, definitely. And that feeling is so special.
Do you know that musical Fun Home?
I literally do. I hoped you were about to bring this up. I had like a fun short-lived podcast with a dear friend of mine where we like also interviewed queer people. And my recurring question for everybody was like, what was your Ring of Keys moment?
Right. Okay, great.
Like what was your moment of like baby queer recognition? Because I think it's so special.
It is. Yeah. So what was it? What was it?
I don't know. I don't know what it was for me. I don't think that I have specific memories of clocking queer people in real life at a young age, I don't think. I remember hearing the word homosexual for the first time in an episode of The Simpsons.
Right.
The episode Homer's Phobia, which I think John Waters guest stars in. And Marge says to Homer about a friend of his, I hope I'm remembering the episode correctly, but she definitely says, this guy is a homosexual. And I turned to my dad and I was like, what does that mean? And my dad said, that's a man who prefers the company of other men. Because like in the context of that image, that's like, that's what Marge was describing. And like, you know, God bless him. He was like, I know what question you're asking. Okay, here's what I think the right thing to say is right now, which I really understand. So it was like hearing the words and the definitions and not really knowing what they meant. And then as I was sort of like finishing primary school, like grade 5 and 6, and sex ed was starting, my parents, in addition to the stuff that I was doing at school, got me like a book about puberty. And they were like, read this. And then if you have any questions about what you've read in this, you can come and talk to us. And that's totally cool, which I think was a very cool move.
Yeah, that's lovely.
But in that book in particular, there was like quite comprehensive information about gay people in it, being like, yeah, like some people are like interested in the same kind of person as them. And some people are interested in both. And like, that's everybody. And that's a possibility. And that's fine. And I think by then I knew that, or like had an awareness of that. But that was a time that I remember seeing that information like woven into what was being communicated to me on purpose, you know?
Right.
But I remember being like 9 or 10 and being like, yeah, I like girls, I'm pretty sure. And then very quickly going, I will think about that later.
Yep. That is going to go in a little box in the back of my brain. Exactly. And I will not deal with it yet.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
It takes a lot of hard work to make it look easy. This Mother's Day, Duluth Trading Co. can help you give her something that keeps up. Whether you prefer to shop online or in-store, Duluth has a motherload of gear, goods, and gifts to keep her comfortable and capable, no matter what needs doing. With Duluth's problem-solving details and legendary durability to boot, you'll finally be mom's favorite again. Check out DuluthTrading.com for all your Mother's Day gifting needs.
Were there out kids at school? Because I know you're a bit younger than me.
Yeah.
That would have been inconceivable in my school.
I was the out kid at school.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I had my first girlfriend when I was like 15. And we were in, what grade were we in? 10 by then? 9 or 10? Mm-hmm. But yeah, my girlfriend and I like were the out couple in our year. So like for a second, that was a position I had.
Yeah. Was it scary?
No. I mean, there were like unpleasant things about it. Like I remember being in a food court with her and like some private school girls throwing rolled up bits of paper at us. Mm. And I being told not to hold hands or like being told that like our affection with each other was inappropriate when there were like straight couples doing the same thing. And like, that's fine, you know, stuff like that. But then I also remember like a seventh grader, like going up to my best friend and being like, can you tell Liv thank you for me? It was a multifaceted experience. And then also at the same time, it was quite matter of fact for me because I was like, well, I'm not doing anything. Like, I'm just dating her. Mm-hmm. This is just what is naturally occurring to me, you know, and then everything else sort of feels like it's happening outside of me or the experience that I'm having. So I didn't think about it all that much, really, beyond registering that, like, some of the ways we were being treated was incredibly unfair and also recognizing that being out was a kind of power or like a powerful thing, an important thing. And I mean, there were other queer people around, like a bunch of people like came out in a domino effect in the subsequent years, as tends to happen, you know, like the sort of gay dominoes that everybody ends up doing around that bracket of your life. I think like by the time we finished high school, it was like, oh yeah, here we all are, you know?
Yeah.
Which was lovely.
That's really, I don't know, inspiring that you were, because I feel like now you are fiercely out and you're unapologetically yourself, as you rightly should be, and you're talking about your experience in such a open and beautiful and honest way. But it sounds like you've always been that person. You were brave enough to be that person when you were young as well.
Thank you.
Which I definitely wasn't.
It's funny because it's kind of true, and also it's true at the same time that I like tortured myself about it for years, you know, where it's like there was this piece of me that had some clarity or some expression about it quite young. And also I put myself through the ringer about it anyway, you know, where it was like I still battled the kind of internalized homophobia that like makes you like check every few years, like, well, I don't know, I should check, I guess. It's like, who is that for? Why? What do you mean? You know, or like a lack of ease with oneself that means that you like act against your own desire or like don't actively act in league with your own desire. It is interesting to think about for me, like those two equal truths of my experience as a young person, which like there was always a piece of me that was quite out and clear and expressive. And also a piece of me that was quite like punitive and stifling and like tricky. Like those two things existed within me in equal weight. Like I knew so young that I was queer and frankly that I was non-binary. I knew so young and it still took me up until into adulthood to like settle into myself completely, you know?
Oh, totally. I knew I was a lesbian from before my teens, but it wasn't until I was in my late 20s, early 30s even, that I really dressed how I wanted to dress.
Yeah.
Without checking that I was doing it in the right way or not being too this or not being too that, or I don't want to be, what about if it's recognizable from the first time someone sees me? And now I'm like, well, give a fuck about that.
Yeah.
But there was still, even though I was sort of out and even in like more of a public way with my stand-up, there was still sort of elements of, I look back at some of my early stand-up now and go, oh, I was sort of internally homophobic quite publicly, which is quite grim. But there was sort of a way of managing my fears of what people thought about me.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring up looking at a past version of yourself, because I think about myself all the time. Like whenever I come across images of myself at different points throughout my life, I'm like, oh, I can see what that person is at peace with and what they're not, and like what that person is struggling with and what they're not.
And that must be big for you, because it's in like a very public sphere.
Yeah.
Like I imagine there's pictures of you on like a red carpet.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, who's that person?
I mean, particularly in terms of like coming into like a sense of peace and security with my gender identity, like I was out to my friends as a teenager. And then when I started acting for a living coming into my 20s, I sort of like re-closeted myself, because I was like, well, obviously I can't do this for a living and say that. Like, obviously that's not allowed. So it was like, okay, I guess I'll just pretend to be a woman for the rest of my life. And maybe people will read my diaries later and then it'll be fine. It's just like, oh my God, just compromise it to an unsustainable and nonsensical degree, right? Because it's like, that is going to suck.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, I remember when I got into drama school, I had a girlfriend and I remember thinking, I can choose now whether to be a lesbian or an actress.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to drama school straight.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, well, my only frame of reference is like Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi.
Yeah.
And that didn't go good for them when they first came out.
No. And that's the thing, is that like the awareness of the stakes and like that fear is actually not irrational. And like that's the painful, miserable thing about it, is that like the fear you had of like, I think my sexuality and my career are in conflict. It's like, well, historically that has been and often still is very true. That like the stakes are very high, and like it does change what it is like to be in public and what it is like to do that job. And like that is the infuriating piece of it, you know.
When you say you were out, but then when you moved to LA to act sort of for a living, you went back in the closet. Were you getting those feelings from anything outside of yourself? Had it been suggested to you? Were you allowed to be out with regards to sexuality? Or did you just think, I'm not going to talk about myself at all?
It was really specifically about being non-binary. That was the thing that felt impossible to be expressive about.
Oh, and understandably.
Yeah.
Because it feels like you're a trailblazer in that respect.
I really do appreciate that. Thank you.
Liv is wincing. I can see them and they are wincing.
But it's just, I guess it was an extension of the impossibility I had felt about it as a teenager, realizing it about myself in the first place, where it was like, I remember figuring out that I was non-binary and then 5 seconds later figuring out that I probably couldn't tell very many people.
Did you read the term non-binary? How did you even come across it?
I did. So I knew that I was queer, and I was coming off the back of recovering from a quite serious eating disorder and like piecing together feelings that I had about my body that I hadn't dealt with ever, you know, and like feelings about my sexuality and like what it was like to be myself. I'm like, okay, something's going on with me, and something's always been going on with me. And like, what is it exactly? Because it's something about my body, and it's something about being in it, and it's in there somewhere. And I swear to God, like, I'm going to figure out what it is.
And did that click in puberty when your body started changing, that sort of disconnect?
Yeah, it did. So, you know, a bit of a clue there. I was just like scrabbling around for like queer history information, like queer community information, because I was like, I know this applies to me. I know I'm in here, and I know this is where the answers are for me. I know this is important. And like, it's important point blank, because like, this is information about the human experience that for some reason isn't as available as other kinds of information. So I was just like taking books home from the library. I was like furrowing around my city. I was like digging through stuff my parents had or looking for things on my own. I was looking at stuff online. It was just like bits and pieces from everywhere. And then like in reading about like people's varied experiences of gender throughout history and throughout culture, I was like, okay, hang on, like hang on a second. So I think this actually might be more complex than anyone's told me before. And it was just like, it's just a lot of things coalescing at once, like my understanding of an interest in feminism and like queer theory and like gender studies, just on my own, just like doing a bunch of research on my own. But in doing that, I came across the term non-binary and immediately was like, oh, that's it. Like, yeah, that's what my deal is 100%. And then like reading about the possibility of like alternative pronoun use, like people using like Z and here in the 80s and 90s, or like ways that people have been spoken about in different languages and at different points in time of just like, oh, so hang on. So I actually have some say in this. Like if something feels correct, if something is correct for me, I can just ask for it and get it and that's fine. Like that was huge. And then 5 seconds off the back of that was like, okay, I'm non-binary and the way that I want people to refer to me is with they, them pronouns. And that feels great. And I think I've solved it. And I can't tell anyone this. Like I told my close friends and that was it for a long time. So as I was starting to act, I was like, well, I have had the understanding for some time that like my friends can know this about me and my family will at some point know this about me. And to hope for anything else is madness, you know? So it was kind of a non-issue. Like, so nobody told me what decisions to make about it because I didn't even let it get that far. I remember as I was starting out, the one thing I allowed myself was like leaving little breadcrumbs for those in the know to recognize. Like I had my pronouns in my bio on like social media accounts of mine. And I was like, the people who know what that means will know what I'm talking about. Cause this is like a while ago now.
Yeah. Before we were all doing it.
Exactly. So I was like, but the other non-binary people will clock that and I will make that be enough for me. And then gradually I would start getting asked about that more and more. And I remember the first time a journalist actually, when I was promoting a television show, was like, hey, says they, them in your bio. Is that something you want to talk about? And at the time I was like, yes, soon. Like, yes, right. Soon, but give me a second. Cause it started to dawn on me that like, not only do I want to be more expressive about this, I'm going to need to be more expressive about this because the current state of affairs is not sustainable at all. But it took me some time to like internalize that that was possible. And that like, not only was it going to be okay, but it was going to be better. It's going to be actively good for me, better for me. It wasn't going to ruin anything. It was actively going to improve things. And then it gradually got more and more comfortable being expressive about it the more and more I did it. And now it's like, I wouldn't go back for anything.
Yeah. It's so interesting you say about reading throughout history, because I think for lots of queer people, when you sort of go quite often, or certainly people of my generation, you're a little younger than me, but there's something enormously liberated when you realize that people like you have been before.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you go, oh, I'm sort of connected to this big history of people. Even though, you know, biologically we don't have a link, but there's this link between us that I can't put my finger on the words for it right now, but it means that I get you and
yes,
you get me, and there's a connection for us.
It's so special.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reading a novel recently about lesbians in the 20s.
Yeah.
And I found it thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
Like how they lived, the language that they used, how they like showed themselves to each other in a public place without straight people realizing. And I couldn't stop reading it.
That's right.
It was so thrilling
yeah.
to be like, ah, people like me, we've always been.
We literally always have.
We really have.
Yeah. And the erasure serves a purpose. You know, it is not accidental that information is hard to find, or that information is like rare or precious, because it allows people to pretend that queerness is new and therefore not legitimate. You know, like the ahistorical nature of it is not an accident. So it's like when people have the knee-jerk reaction of like, this is made up and recent, what that reaction is counting on is that there isn't a history to refer back to. You know, it's like, but there is. There absolutely is.
Oh, I mean, yeah, you know, it's not surprising that some of the first books that were burnt in the Second World War were books about gender identity and sexuality.
Exactly.
Like, trying to stop people being allowed to read that they exist, which, you know, we're seeing now across the States. What's it like being in the States at the moment? Because it's something I've sort of flirted with coming over and gigging at some point or another. But do you feel, obviously you're in LA, which I assume is progressive.
Yeah, like my experience of it has been, yeah.
Yeah, but do you feel like you're living somewhere that's quite hostile to people like us at the moment?
I mean, like structurally that just is true right now, you know. Like I'm very conscious of that, and then I'm also conscious of the fact that I feel that in the air other places as well. Like I feel that's kind of true about the UK right now too.
Oh, for sure. The UK's, yeah, it's a bin fire.
Yeah, and Australia is definitely not immune to that either. And like that's the sort of like sinister, uneasy thing for me at the moment is I'm like, I don't think it's about place necessarily. Like the structural backslide that's happening right now is a bit of a web, and that's what concerns me so much. So I am really conscious of that. And on like an individual emotional level, like it makes me incredibly fiercely determined, to be honest. Because it's like, we are not going anywhere. And like, I'm not going to entertain this. Like, I'm not going to give this the time of day. Like, it builds like a wall in me or something, where it's like, it makes me so fiercely determined to ensure that the future will be bright for queer and trans people, you know, where it's like, I feel shored up almost. Where it's like, I'm going to be doing everything in my power to make sure that the future is a safe and happy one. And you will have to deal with me, you know? That's how I feel.
Well, I think it's brilliant.
Thank you.
I think it's brilliant. I'm gushing over you a lot, Liv. I'm sorry about that.
No, thank you.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Elevate your game in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe, the capable SUV that features premium interiors with available captain's chairs, available dual wireless device charging, and bold new technology, all with plenty of room for your cargo and crew. Okay, Hyundai. Visit HyundaiUSA.com to learn more about the all-new 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe.
I read quite a lot about the gender euphoria you felt since your top surgery.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you'd share a little bit about that with me and the listeners about how you came to decide to do that. I know that some non-binary people choose to, some non-binary people choose not to do that.
Yeah.
And yeah, what that euphoria was like for you.
Oh, man.
I always try and get as much euphoria into this podcast as possible because I think it's so easy to find so much, certainly when I speak to someone that's trans or non-binary, to get as much joy in, because yes. I think that places like this is where people will maybe come and seek it out if they need a little bit of that.
Oh, big time. Yeah, I think it's really important. So I knew that like top surgery was something that I wanted or that would be necessary for me to like be at ease. I knew that so young. I remember being like 16 or 17 and talking to my friends about it. And like, I tricked my mom into ordering me a binder off the internet. And then like, I wore it for a while, but realized that like, for me, a lot of the discomfort was tactile, was about sensation. So like strapping something to me and making me more aware of my chest was helpful to a point, but like ultimately didn't solve anything. So it was just like, it was a constant matter of like compromise of like, okay, I guess I'll just live like this, I suppose. But I knew that I wanted it for so long. I thought about it for 10 years, for so long. Mm. Like the surgery center that I ended up going to, I had their website open on a tab on my computer for 5 years.
Wow.
And sometimes I would just go and look at it and then I would close it and open it again and just like stare at it or just like have it open in my web browser and just like sometimes refer to it there, but then go away and do something else. But I knew that it would help me. But I didn't think it was possible. It was like, oh, it's gonna hurt my career, or like, I'm not gonna be taken seriously as a non-binary patient. There were so many internal blocks that I felt about it. I felt like a lot of shame about it almost, or in, it just didn't feel like I was allowed somehow, where it was like, this is what I want, but like, who cares what you want? You know, I think is a game that I played with myself for a long time. It was quite punishing the way that I would run myself in circles about it. And then I think like the domino effect of me finally getting it probably started with a few things, probably started with starting to be out publicly and realizing that that was not only all right, but actively good. And then to be honest, I think a big part of it was the psychological changes that began as the pandemic was starting.
Right.
You know, just in terms of like, oh, what are we doing? Like, you know, the complete psychological adjustment that I think everybody's gone through in some form over the last few years, that will happen as you deal with like a huge seismic event that causes the world to shut down for a while. Like, people reevaluated their relationship to work. Like people reevaluated their relationship to like the cities they live in, or like the friendships they have, or the partners they had, or like, I think naturally a big change like that will have a run-on effect for a lot of people. And I think for me, a part of that was like a priority shift almost. Not to say that it's only about the pandemic, because I think it was about a lot of things. But when I think about how I was feeling at the beginning of 2020 and how I'm feeling now, I do think there is a thread of my priorities changing. My work is not the most important thing, or like I am allowed to reach for the things that are like self-actualizing for me. And life is so short, and like, what am I prevaricating around this for? I deserve to be at peace and like comfortable, and so does everybody else, you know? That's kind of all I have to say about it, really, because I feel like I'm still articulating that piece of it. But I just went through a lot of significant psychological shifts, and one of them was kind of a fuck it, you know, of like, fuck it, I'm like, what am I doing, you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, I don't know what it's like for your work, but certainly for me, like, everything just stopped.
Yeah.
There was just nothing. And there was a moment where you sort of go, oh, I have to be able to exist without performing.
Yeah.
All of the time. Like after about a week, my wife was like, I can't be your only audience member. Like, this has to stop. I can't bear this. I love you, but I can't bear this, which is fair. But, you know, for me, like, and I think for lots of people in sort of our industry, or anyone that's sort of, you know, been a real career person, you know, you just put the headlights on and just like fucking go for it and go for it and go for it. And you're aware there's 10 people behind you for the job, and you've got to go in for this and go in for that, and you've got to learn this and learn that. And you just got on this treadmill, and then it enforced this stop in all of us. And I think for many of us, it sort of made you go, oh, what am I without my job? Because it is just my job.
Yeah.
It can't be everything, because jobs, you know, you have good years, bad years, and who am I in a bad year?
Yeah.
You've got to be able to still be at peace with who you are. Well, I did. I had to be happy when I wasn't working, which was a bit of a mental, I got a therapist, it was all good.
The irony is, right, that like once you are comfortable with yourself, you get better at your job.
100%. 100%.
So funny.
For sure. For sure, as soon as you are at peace, I think as a performer, I don't, you know, on stage or on camera, as soon as you are not trying to be a thing, you're just doing it.
And it works.
It works.
It's so funny.
And you go, oh, fucking hell, what was I doing for 10 years?
I know.
Exactly. Like putting on silly hats and pretending to be people. You just got to, it makes no sense. Now, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk a bit more about Yellow Jackets.
Please, yeah.
One thing I would love to know, because people that haven't seen it, I mean, just stop this podcast, pause it, come back to it, please, but go and watch it. But the fact there are sort of two time periods happening, one of the young girls in the wilderness, and then, sorry, young people in the wilderness.
Yeah, Travis is there too.
Yep, absolutely. I keep thinking he's going to die, but he hasn't yet, for where I'm at. But then there's the adults in the future, and you're sort of working out who's lived, who's been eaten.
Oh, yeah.
The actors are so brilliant at being each other.
That's so good.
I want to know, like, how much like rehearsal happened? What, because even down to like how people are walking, how they're holding their, the way that they're using the dialogue, in that you could speak things 5, 10, 20 different ways, but they all seem to have like the entity of the character. How did that come about?
It really varies from pair to pair.
Okay.
There was no, as far as I'm aware anyway, there was never any like structural rehearsal process as described by the show. It was really up to like the pairs of actors playing the same character to decide how much process they wanted to share. So it really varied from person to person. Like, I know at one stage during season one, like, Jasmine texted Tawny to be like, do we say either or either? Like, what do we do? Sam and Christina, like, they both pushed their glasses up the same way, never talked about it once. Like, just both automatically did that. So, but, like, have talked about other things. But that one just fucking cinched right away. So it varies.
And what about you for season two? How much did you guys...
Lauren and I talked a bit about Van and like asked each other some questions and like swapped thoughts about some things. And Simone playing older Lottie too, those two were in kind of a unique position of like having like a set frame of reference already. Where like, I think for the other pairs, like particularly in season one, it was like, okay, the two of us decide who this person is together now. Whereas with Lauren and Simone this year, it was like, okay, so here's what Liv and Courtney have been doing, you know?
Yeah.
And then we springboard out together from there. So that was like a fun piece of it too, was like being a frame of reference for somebody. And then as a result, like, suddenly being confronted with the way you stand.
Yeah.
You know, you see someone else doing it, which was really thrilling. But it's been so fun to watch what Lauren brings to it. And like when she came on board, that was something that I was very passionate about, was like, I want you to have equal ownership over this person as well. Like, I want to see what you think, like what you decide to do, what you want. Because like, that's the exciting thing about this experience, is like, who knows what they're going to be like in 25 years, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody. So who is this person in 25 years? Like, oh my God, I don't know. What do you think? Like, let's figure it out. It's been really exciting.
And it obviously, to watch, it feels like such a sort of ensemble and sort of collaborative piece. When you're filming, is it a script that you guys have to like stick to word for word? Or are there like, because it feels loose when you watch it, because it's, you know, when you're like walking through the snow or the scenes in the house when things get a bit crazy.
Yeah.
How much of that is sort of scripted word for word, exactly what you've done in the rehearsal room to, or at the read through to, or is there moments of improvisation?
I mean, the writing on this show is so good. And like,
it's so good.
We're so lucky to work with the team of writers that we do. I love improvising and do it quite a bit. And then sometimes in like group scenes, like if like the rhythm of something is tweaked a certain way, or it will, or like it's, there is a tiny bit of flexibility, I would say. I mean, off, like, we don't really need it.
That shows how tight the script is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's moments where you sort of go, as someone that has been on set before, you go, oh, that looks really organic. But I guess if the writing's that good.
Yeah.
That's what it does.
Yeah, sometimes we'll chuck things in there, and then sometimes, like, the writers will be on set, obviously, so sometimes it'll be a matter of, like, going over to them and being like, hi, tell me if you hate this, but I actually would love to say this instead. Is that okay? And oftentimes they're like, yeah, totally. Or sometimes they're like, actually, we need this for this reason, but totally understand why you've asked. Right. So, like, there is like a bit of a back and forth in that respect, which I love, because like, that's not necessary. Like, we could just as easily be told like, go away, like, say what we told you to say and stop asking questions. But like, we all care about the show so much and love living in these characters so much that it's like, there's a passion for it. So the times where we do improvise, or where we do for clarity on something, or ask to make an adjustment, like, it never feels charged for me. It's always like, I feel like a kid in a sandbox, you know, where it's like, oh, I think it would be actually really cool if we put a stick in the sandbox over here. Is that crazy? You tell me if that's crazy, you know? But oftentimes they're like, no, a stick would be great. Let's do it.
That's nice. And it sort of left it open for a third series.
We got renewed, yeah.
Great. That's exciting. When do you begin?
Well, it depends on what happens with this.
Oh, the writer strike.
Yeah.
Of course. So you're on pause.
Yeah, totally. Totally on pause.
Like everyone else.
Exactly. And it's like, absolutely, you know, absolutely. We're
on pause. Yes, absolutely.
We got to get this sorted out and everything else can wait.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's next for you? Obviously waiting until the writer's strike finishes, but you write as well. Is that right?
I have before. So when I was younger, actually like the first thing I ever made a little bit of money doing creatively was writing plays as like a younger, it's like in my late teens. It's been a while. It's been a while since I've like finished or put anything out, but like I tap away at stuff for my own amusement all the time. And it's something that I love to do, that I know how to do, that I could totally see myself like making a piece of my professional life again. Well, so we'll see. But that's more like long-term future stuff for me, I think. The immediate short-term, like for me and for everybody right now, is like twiddling our thumbs a little bit. It's like using this opportunity to like stand in really strong solidarity with each other and make the best of like the time that it affords us, you know? Or it's a very important moment in time for our industry. And it's like about giving that the weight that it deserves. And then,
yeah, you're absolutely right. Without the words, what we got?
Yeah.
Without the stories.
Yeah, it's really important. It feels quite historic, to be honest. It's like what happens in and around this particular moment in time will have a massive run-on effect for what the future of the industry is like. And that's really important. It's like what happens next year is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Liv, I've loved this conversation.
Me too.
I'm just going to ask you one more question, which is what I ask absolutely everyone that comes on the show.
Yeah.
And I'm maybe thinking of the version of Liv at school, holding hands with your girlfriend, maybe girls at a private school being little bitches over there. And if you could pick up a phone to them, or indeed to someone that is experiencing something a little bit similar at the moment, working out who they are in the world, if you could give them just a little bit of advice, a little bit of encouragement, what would you say?
You are sticking around, so it is in your best interest to start acting like it as soon as possible.
Perfect. That is the perfect way to end this conversation. I am eternally grateful. Thank you so much, Liv.
Thank you.
The brilliant Liv Hewson. I loved that one. I'll be back next week with another brilliant conversation. If you want to get in touch with me, you always can. The email is hello@withsusieruffle.com. Take care. Bye-bye.